Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is Brian Lehrer's Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, February 24th. I'm Bridget Bergen from the WNYC and Gothamist Newsroom, filling in for Brian Lehrer, who's off today. As you've undoubtedly heard, Russia has launched a military attack on Ukraine, a full-scale attack from multiple directions, according to Ukraine's foreign minister, with explosions heard in the Ukrainian capital. In a statement last night, President Biden condemned the attack as unprovoked and unjustified, promising the world will hold Russia accountable for what he expects to be catastrophic loss of life and human suffering. He's meeting virtually with the G7 leaders this morning and is expected to address the nation this afternoon. While the Russian invasion of Ukraine is the most high-stakes situation demanding his attention, President Biden has said he would announce his pick for the Supreme Court this month, which ends Monday, and his first State of the Union address is scheduled for Tuesday. To talk about all of this, including what more the U.S. could do to halt Russia and the other matters vying for the president's attention, we're joined by Philip Bump, national correspondent at The Washington Post, where he writes the How to Read This Chart newsletter. Philip, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Philip, let's start with Putin and Ukraine, where there's so much at stake politically, geopolitically, and very personally for those under attack. What are you seeing as the situation on the ground now?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, obviously, I'm based outside New York City, so my view is through the lens of reporting and social media. There are a lot of, you know, I think one of the things that's really remarkable about the conflict as it unfolds is how well documented it is. There was a point that was made by someone that I think is accurate, which is, you know, the fact that this buildup was weeks in the making meant that there's a lot of reporters on the ground. This is occurring in a very modern Western country where a lot of people have access to social media. So we can really get a sense for what's happening in real time. And what's happening is really, really stark. I think a lot of people who may have not been tracking this overnight, who woke up to the news this morning, may not understand the extent of what's happening. This is not simply Russia trying to lock down what it has claimed are these two independent states in the eastern part of the country. This is a broad attack across the Ukraine that is now threatening the capital of Kyiv, that has already incurred damage in a number of major cities throughout the country. It is fundamentally what Putin said, that he aimed to demilitarize Ukraine. This is not something that is limited in scope, and I think that's important to echo.
As I said, President Biden and the European allies have condemned the attack and had already imposed some very tough sanctions, but Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so there's no obligation to intervene militarily, and the U.S. has said it won't, correct?
Yes, repeatedly. And I think there's very little appetite domestically for that to happen, or at least there was prior to the events of the past 12 hours or so. I'm not sure if that changes significantly. But the U.S. has been very adamant that they're not going to send, that we are not going to send troops to Ukraine to fight Russia. However, it does seem, given the extent of the conflict in Ukraine that is now encroaching on the borders of NATO allied countries, there's already been a call to invoke Section 4 of the NATO Accords, which means that people are going to convene and ensure that there are protections for NATO members who are close to the fighting here. There have been other concerns that as Russia engages in the cyber attacks on Ukraine, shutting down institutions in Ukraine, for example, that they could use tools that are rough enough that they could spread into other places as well. So it is not clear that this conflict will remain bounded by Ukraine's borders. And I think that's a broad concern for those who are paying attention to what's happening.
This is obviously very early days and an evolving situation. But do you get a sense of what other information we'll learn today about additional options that are available to the U.S. and allies?
Yeah, so the United States and European partners in particular have apparently been working for some time on a tranche of sanctions that could be applied were Russia to take this step. We've heard about this repeatedly. I think there's a lot of question about why those already haven't been implemented, given the fact that this it's been 14, 16 hours at this point that Russia has been actively engaged in attacking Ukraine broadly. I actually saw one of the editors of the news outlet in Kyiv tweeted, frustrated, you know, where are the sanctions? You know, we were promised very quick sanctions, and it's been, you know, now nearly 12 hours. What's happening? I think we're going to see some broad-scale sanctions, but the question is the extent to which that actually has an immediate effect. I mean, obviously, the threat of sanctions was not a deterrent, and I think that there is some justified skepticism that imposing these sanctions now, you know, what do you do then, right? I mean, do you dust off your hands and say, sorry? I mean, it's you know, not to advocate for an expanded military presence, but it's not really clear once those sanctions, which have already been threatened, are actually in place, how that then, where the deterrent effect comes for Russia at that point.
In terms of what this means for politics in the United States, I seem to remember a time when there was a saying, politics stops at the water's edge, meaning Democrats and Republicans might be in a locked struggle over domestic politics, but willing to work together when it came to foreign policy. You wrote about part of why that is very much not the case with Ukraine. It's deeply embedded in recent U.S. politics, not just different approaches, but actual electoral politics. Can you hit on some of those highlights?
Yeah, I'm actually writing something about this right now for the Post, but fundamentally, we've seen since 2014, since even prior to the Trump era in American politics, we've seen this increasing alliance between the American political right and Russia's interests. You know, obviously, this is sort of an ad hoc alliance, largely, but there is sort of sympathetic feints back and forth between those two groups. And I think that was strengthened both by Russia's efforts in 2016, by Trump's approach to Russia over the course of his presidency, and, you know, incidents like Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine's president in 2019, you know, to try and dig up dirt on Joe Biden at the expense of actually, you know, providing defensive armaments to Ukraine. But one of the things that we're seeing that I think is really important for us to remember is we are seeing a transition in American politics away from Democrats and Republicans sharing a united goal of, you know, making America better and sort of disagreeing on policy, to Democrats and Republicans seeing each other as enemies and seeing each other as, you know, one force or the other trying to actually undermine the United States itself. And so if you are someone who sees the other side politically as an enemy who's trying to undercut the United States, it seems then almost rational to look overseas for allies in that fight. And so we see a lot of folks, particularly on the political right in this moment, you know, people like Steve Bannon, people like even President Trump and some of the comments he's made recently, who are expressing some appreciation for Vladimir Putin at the expense of President Biden, in part because they see Putin as allied in their common fight against America's left, which is, I think, a reflection of the broad partisan divide that has erupted over the course of the past several decades.
I know that in the past, we've certainly heard former President Trump side with Putin and you know, calling him a genius, smart, savvy. Mm-hmm. Given the stakes of what we're seeing right now, have we heard anything from the former president at this point? And how does that play into how people understand what's happening on the ground there?
Yeah, I mean, we President Trump, the former president, called into Fox News Laura Ingraham's opinion show last night and, you know, immediately tried to say that this is because the 2020 election is rigged. I mean, I think that it is very easy to overestimate the extent to which Donald Trump is really thinking things through on this stuff. And, you know, I think that he is representative of a certain faction in American politics, but I'm not sure that he is doing anything besides self-promotion at any given point when he's considering these things. So, you know, his goal here, he's looking at 2024 and thinking he might run against Biden, so he's going to use this as an opportunity to tear down Biden. I mean, obviously, that's, you know, something that is detrimental broadly, potentially, to the United States. That said, there are elements, there are people like Tucker Carlson on Fox News who are actively promoting Vladimir Putin's worldview here. There are others who are saying, hey, Putin's got a real point in terms of the threat posed by Ukraine, which I think no actual foreign policy analyst treats with any great credibility. But that's the argument that was being made by Vladimir Putin. And there are people in the United States who are saying this is something that ought to be treated seriously, which I think can be evaluated on its own merits.
I want to go to one of our callers. Bila in Stamford, Connecticut. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. I'm a former participant of the Hungarian Revolution and like to share some of my experiences in connection with the Ukraine. And one of those is my advice for the United Nations to send troops immediately to protect the Ukrainian government and military leaders, because our experience was that that's the very first thing the Russians go after. In case of Hungary, the head of the army was invited after a staged withdrawal by the Russians, was invited to their headquarters, arrested, and later hanged. And that destroyed the total resistance of the army. The other thing I'd like to mention is that for the average population, the Molotov cocktail is a very important tool in a street fight in cities. And in that connection, people have to think of the practical details, such as have a wine bottle or something and empty it, and make sure that you have gasoline, which you fill it with, and then put a piece of cloth in it so that when the tank is coming, you light.
Abila, thank you so much for sharing what sounds like an incredibly traumatic experience during your time in Hungary, and the comparisons and sympathies that you are sharing with what people in Ukraine are experiencing. I want to pivot back, Philip, to how the U.S. is responding, and in this particular case, how Congress is responding to the invasion. Do we know yet what their response has been so far?
Well, there's a pretty remarkable document that came out yesterday in which a number of members of Congress from across the political spectrum called on President Biden to ensure that if there were to be military deployments targeting Russia, you know, if there were essentially to be an expanded conflict in which the United States is engaged, to actually involve Congress in that decision making. That's something that's been avoided by presidents in you know, recent history. I think it reflects both the fact that Congress is trying to ensure that it's protecting its own power, but also broadly reflects concern about the way in which the American military has been deployed in the past for, you know, open-ended engagements, as we saw obviously after the 9/11 attacks. The question of sanctions, you know, again, we have heard repeatedly from the administration that these sanctions are essentially locked and loaded and they're ready to go. We've not seen them deployed. We understand that President Biden is going to address the nation at 12:30 today. So it may be the case that he actually announces something then or clarifies what has already gone into place. But again, you know, if the United States, justifiably, given public sentiment and given, you know, recent experience, is not going to engage militarily with Russia directly, then there's not a lot that can be done. I mean, it certainly is the case that the United States has corralled a lot of international support and opposition to Russia. That's part of the reason that Biden and American intelligence agencies were so direct in saying, here is what Putin is planning, this is what it looks like, and this is what we expect to happen, was to sort of make sure that people understood the stakes and to get those ducks in a row. But there is a point at which, you know, there is a very big difference between enacting a sanction on Vladimir Putin and his allies and the fact that Russian, you know, some 200,000 Russian forces are at this point crossing the border into Ukraine.
Jennifer in Astoria. Jennifer, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thank you. For the State of the Union on Tuesday, I want to hear President Biden's full-throated support of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the urgency of getting it passed and implemented before the 2024 election. The events in Europe right now are extremely concerning, and they obviously deserve our attention and our resources, but we have to keep our eyes on the long game. None of the conversations that we're having today will have any durability if we can't fortify our own elections against our own American autocrats and his supporters that are holding office in our own government.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. Philip, any reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, the the challenge of being president is you don't always get to set your agenda. And I think that Biden has, and you know, he's deployed Vice President Harris to take lead on this. He has repeatedly advocated for passage of that and other changes to the electoral process. But he can't, you know, I mean, you know, hopefully this resolves in a positive way before next week. It seems extremely unlikely, but who knows? And so then he can sort of, you know, redirect his attention elsewhere. But he doesn't get to choose the urgent crises that are in front of him, nor, of course, in the case specifically of that legislation, does he get to choose the senators who are willing to come along with him on it. That's been the roadblock. It hasn't necessarily been Biden's advocacy, but instead opposition from members of his own party.
Spencer in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Spencer, welcome to WNYC. What are you listening for next week in the president's speech?
Thank you for having me on. I'm really hoping that President Biden will be taking a more active stance during his speech. The last year and a half or so, I felt that the president's been fairly passive in terms of letting Congress attempt to establish its legislative agenda. Not necessarily lobbying before the American people in the correct way that would have resulted in, you know, all kinds of different outcomes that we're currently dealing with. It's interesting that Biden was vice president to former President Obama. Obama came into office. There were lots of different problems that were waiting on his doorstep, domestic and international. And he took a very active stance on most of them, the one exception being when Congress debated or deliberated over the Affordable Care Act, the end result being something that almost no one has been happy with, either for or against. Unfortunately, in my opinion, President Biden has been very similar with regard to deliberation on the Voting Rights Act and in terms of trying to get through Build Back Better and all of the other plans where he let Congress take point. And the end result was not, in my opinion, to the American people's overall benefit. So with everything going on in Ukraine, with everything going on with the United States trying to get out of the pandemic with a bifurcated economy, the president needs to, again, take the stance of angry Joe, which he was a few weeks back when he said he's tired of being quiet or tired of, you know, being polite. We need that Biden in front of the podium because Spencer, the way that the situation is,
Spencer, thanks so much for your call. And that leads me to this question of tone, Philip. You know, there's been a fair amount of commentary on what tone the president should adopt, that his July 4th barbecue promise means he should hedge on sounding victorious over COVID. And now, of course, the war in Europe. You know, we hear that in our callers who, you know, despite, as you pointed out, the fact that the president can't, you know, even if he supports certain legislation, can't force senators to support it with him. It seems like a lot is at stake for him in this speech next week. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know the extent to which the State of the Union addresses generally move public opinion. I think, though, that he very much needs to send a message to his base that he is engaged in a fight. You know, I think one of the challenges, Biden did a very good job at the outset in terms of setting expectations, particularly on the pandemic. He set sort of low bar estimates for where the country was going to be in terms of its approach to the pandemic. He surpassed them. He received, you know, justified appreciation for that. But since then, he's done a relatively bad job of setting expectations, you know, claiming, you know, sort of arguing that he's going to be able to pass all these sort of sweeping legislative goals, which have been stymied, again, not because of his lack of advocacy, but because of the composition of the Senate primarily. And so one of the challenges he has at this moment is he does need to encourage his base and, you know, say to his base, we're fighting hard and we're out there, but he is going to, again, be in the position where he's not going to be able to deliver on that. You know, he's not going to get Joe Manchin to come along with him on his, you know, his expanded Build Back Better program. And so if he's not going to do that, he can stand up there and say, hey, we're going to do this and we're going to fight for voting rights and we're going to fight for Build Back Better. But then he's not going to deliver. And does that do him more or less good politically? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I don't envy his political team in trying to have to navigate that.
Cheryl in Soho. Cheryl, you're going to be our last caller for this segment. Welcome to WNYC.
Welcome, longtime listener. It's a quickie. If he wants any hope for the midterms, I certainly hope he brings in something about forgiving student debt, The kids need it. They are absolutely getting squished. And they're in self-interest for everybody. There's got to be some serious forgiveness for student debt, and I hope he mentions it.
That's Cheryl, all. Thank you so much for that. Philip, before we let you go, I want to ask you about those truckers. The Canadian truckers managed to mangle traffic and trade in Ottawa and across the border in their mask and vaccine mandate protests. And now their convoys from various parts of the U.S. reportedly on their way to Washington. It is an odd moment, given that mask mandates seem to be falling by the wayside as Omicron infections wane. What could be the impact of this?
It's a good question. I mean, one of the things we don't know yet is the actual scale of people who will arrive in, you know, on the East Coast in Washington, for example. There was the one guy who left from Scranton, Pennsylvania, who was literally just one truck and then ended up getting lost and stuck in traffic, right? So, you know, we don't know what might actually show up. I think it is a very good signal that these protests, particularly in the United States, are not really predicated on COVID, but rather just broadly oppositional to the Democratic president. I mean, I think that it's very safe to say that that's the case here. There aren't, you know, the trucker protest in Canada was a protest about having to cross the border, having to be vaccinated across the border, which a lot of the truckers there have to do simply by virtue of, you know, the way the carrying is oriented. That is not the same sort of constraint that applies in the United States. And so I think that a lot of this is just sort of, hey, here was a way. And we saw this. We saw a lot of people on the political right internationally saying this is a way to sort of stick it to the elites in the power structures that was not necessarily predicated entirely on COVID. And I think that's sort of what this response is. We'll see, you know, but you're right. It's going to look particularly bad if the United States is trying to navigate a geopolitical crisis to have these truckers stand, you know, parked in the streets honking about COVID mandates that don't exist.
And one more question before you go, a national story with very local ties, some new developments in the Trump criminal investigation out of New York City District Attorney's DA Alvin Bragg's office. Evidently, he wasn't convinced by the grand jury investigation that started under his predecessor, Cy Vance. Two of the attorneys in his office leading the investigation resigned yesterday. Any idea what that means for the case against the Trump organization?
Well, I think it bodes very poorly for the case at the Manhattan level. But I think that the bigger threat to Trump has long been at the state level with Attorney General Tisha James, who's still apparently pressing forward, recently got a judge to agree that Trump should have to actually be deposed as part of that case. So while this is a derailing of that particular probe in New York City, there is still the state probe, but there still are other probes. There's the probe in D.C. of the inaugural committee from Trump's first inaugural. There is the probe in Georgia of his efforts to influence the election there. And there still is something that might come out of the January 6th committee in the House as well. So there's still a lot of the ways in which Trump is still at risk, even though this one particular well seems to have tried it.
We're going to have to leave it there. I've been talking with Philip Bump, national correspondent at The Washington Post. Philip, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course, thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.